You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting to Yes And.
You want to come see us talk live on the Getting to Yes And podcast? Well, I'm going to be talking to Keegan-Michael Key, Second City alum, and L. Key about their new book, The History of Sketch Comedy, A Journey Through the Art and Craft of Humor, on October 5th at 7 p.m. at the Francis Parker School. This is part of the Chicago Humanities Festival. If you want to get tickets, go to chicagohumanities.org. Today's podcast is with Hal Hirschfield, who is a professor of marketing, behavioral decision-making, and psychology at UCLA's Anderson School of Management, and holds the UCLA Anderson Board of Advisors term chair in management. He's got a terrific new book. It's called Your Future Self, How to Make Tomorrow Better Today. Enjoy the pod.
Another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Hal Hirschfield, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Kelly. Happy to be here.
In the introduction to your new book, you describe a scenario from a novella by Ted Chiang. Can you actually tell us that scenario and how it relates to the theme of your book?
Yeah, I mean, it's this fantastic sci-fi little short story. And just to be totally clear, my book is not sci-fi. despite my next door neighbor asking me if that was the case. And I was like, I think you don't know what I do. Mm-hmm. And in that particular short story, there is, this, you know, merchant, and there's an alchemist, and the alchemist basically, is going to this little merchant store, and the merchant basically gives him an opportunity to walk through a gate, and essentially step forward in time, and meet his future self. And I won't give away much more than that, but it presents these really interesting questions of what would you want to know? Like, if you were to walk through such a gate, you know, what sort of questions would you ask your future self? Like, would you change anything about the way that you live in the present? And maybe the flip side is like, what questions wouldn't you ask? What would you want to leave to be surprised about? Which I thought was a fascinating sort of angle there. And so much of my research, so much of the book itself is all about the ways that we can get to know and get to shape our future selves, even under the sort of, you know, knowledge that it's very hard to get to know that person. And yet we can do some things now to shape their outcomes and their well-being.
So I'm curious, before, how would you personally have answered that question? Would you have gone to that future portal always, or is that something that's evolved over time?
So I probably would have, and I feel like my knee jerk is still to say, yes, I definitely would. But now, you know, the things I'd want to know are much more general. You know, I'd want to know, you know, am I still happy? You know, is my spouse and my wife, you know, happy and healthy? Like, did things work out okay for my kids? But, you know, I say on the surface because I'm totally fine knowing those things, assuming that the answers are positive.
Well, that's because I ain't going. I am such a hard no on this thing. I don't know. And I thought about it. Like, I didn't even have to think about it quickly. And of course, part, you know, in improvisation, we're so present focused. Right. My wife makes fun of me
in regard to this all the time, because she'd be like, what do you got on for today or this week? And I'm like, I don't know. unless it's like a speaking date where I know I have to wear a thing or go, I don't want to know. I would rather walk in and have the day greet me. And, you know, and also the fear of like, one of those is negative and I got to come back here. And then, you know, I start getting all like Star Trek on it too. Like, am I going to upset the forces of the universe if I try to do something differently based on information I've got?
Oh, 100%. I mean, and this is where this gets like trippy really fast, because if you were to tell me something negative, but I could change it, but it wouldn't have an impact on the rest of the universe. Well, what does that mean? You know, and on and on and on. You
very quickly descending into baby Hitler. Very quickly.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think that one of the most provocative things you say, and it's a short sentence, you are actually a we, to me is really, really important and has come up. Literally, I'm going to be interviewing a sports psychologist who has a very similar take in Michael Gervais in his work around that, because it's this, we're so obsessed, especially in this country, with these ideas of freedom and what they mean. And sometimes I think they do us a disservice, and that being the point, that we are a we.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Right. And I think part of what I take from that sort of idea is that there are different versions of us out there. And we're not sort of just one being, and we're not one being right now in the present. And we're certainly not one over time.
I am wondering whether you got pushback from your editor / publisher over the story that you start chapter one with.
So I did, I start chapter one with this, the story of the serial killer, in Brazil. And I found him, my guilty pleasure, which my wife is well aware of, is that I like to listen to this one true crime podcast. And it's like, the only reason I say it's a guilty pleasure is because I'm always complaining about all the things I have to do. And then it's like, I find time for that. Well, right. Whatever. One of the episodes focused on this serial killer who is actually the real life inspiration for Dexter. He basically only killed quote unquote bad guys, other criminals, right?
Like hundreds of them too, right?
Yes. I mean, and insane. Mm-hmm. And like many of whom were killed while he was in prison, which is like, wow. Now he also got released from prison after 35 years, which is like another insane element of the story. There's these loopholes in the Brazilian penal code, blah, blah, blah. But his story was super interesting because he essentially morphs into a new person. Now, I know we have to question all of this, right? This is, the way he tells it. But after a certain point, at some point he was in prison and he says, if I can only get out of this situation, I promise I will never kill again. I'll never be violent again. And ostensibly that is in fact what he does. Mm-hmm. Now, I thought it was this incredible story of the ways in which we can truly be a we over time, that there's these different versions of us. It's a really extreme case. I didn't get pushback from my publisher. However, the first book talk I gave was to my daughter's first grade class. This wasn't a story I brought up there.
Okay, good. Yeah, it's a fun, provocative way to begin a book about this journey. And I think that this idea of the static oneself, and I find this interesting because obviously in the sort of, we talk about improv a lot on this podcast, but comedy as well occasionally. And Obviously comedy is one of the art forms that absolutely recognizes the many selves. There's nothing funny if someone's consistent. that's the opposite.
So true. That's such a great insight. Yeah.
So this that's a truth. Again, we're reflecting truth. That's what comedy also does. But still, what we're fighting against is a cultural trope that, as Americans, is just continually shoved down our throat in every aspect of literature and film and even music. And it's the soul renegade and this sort of in the unchanging character and the idea, like with politicians, that if they change their mind, they're somehow bad. And you're like, please change your mind.
Right. I find this to be such an interesting thing because to me, it feels so liberating and so freeing to allow for the possibility of change and to allow for the possibility of transformation. But you're right. I never put my finger on it like the way that you said it. It's somewhat of a cultural trope to sort of, you know, value and almost like, I don't know, put up on a pedestal the idea of permanence. And now I think to some degree that that stems from our inability to deal with, you know, thinking about the our own impermanence, right? We don't want to think about that. And we'd also don't want to think about it in terms of like our relationships. It's somewhat confronting to think about my spouse, my wife changing over time or my best friends changing over time. And yet we do.
We do.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Newsflash, everyone. You completely, you do. And I think the people who seem least happy to me and my various friend groups are the ones who stuck to the thing, the same thing that they didn't like before, but it's the thing they know. And whether it's a job or a relationship or whatever, and then they get to this place and it's like, oh, you know, I know in our work, we really value it in terms of improvisation, this idea of transformation that you are, that just being funny really enough for us. It's like, in what way can you transform, which requires this kind of change? There's another way you talk about this, and it's in chapter two when you talk about this business trip to Iceland and the Yale philosophy professor Laurie Paul presenting this idea. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I was in Iceland of all places for this very small academic conference, and like, I just, for what it's worth, that's like not my normal location for small academic conferences. So this is what I'm
a little worried. People are going to think this is like this jet setter who loves serial killers.
Yeah. What a life. What a life. You know, so this was at a point in time where, you know, life was a little freer. We didn't have kids. My wife also came along, and I'm like in this little room. It's like, we're all the way in Iceland. The conference is literally at the Blue Lagoon Spa, which has a conference room, which is hilarious because it's like, you don't go there for the conference room, but there we are. We're in this conference room. And I'm like starting to think a little jealously of my, you know, my wife's out there. She's like gallivanting around Iceland, taking these pictures. I'm stuck in this room. And Laurie Paul, the Yale philosopher, she gets up there and she says, imagine you have this opportunity to become a vampire. And I was like, what a weird question. And she basically kind of like keeps going with this. And she says, you know, all your friends are doing it. They say you'll love it. There's only one catch. Once you become a vampire, you can't undo it. Like, you can't just say like, I'm good. Now I'm going to go back. I'll take the red pill. Now I'll go back. You're that way forever. Mm-hmm. Now, like 3 days, 4 days before the trip, we found out that my wife was pregnant with our first kid. Mm-hmm. And I'm like sitting there in this room. I definitely like run high on the anxiety spectrum anyway, but I'm like sitting there and I'm like starting to have like a massive amount of anxiety because I'm like, oh my God, like my friends are becoming parents. They're telling me it's great. I'm going to become a parent, but I can't undo it. This is just like becoming a vampire. And she sort of jumps in and she's like, of course, this story is all about becoming a parent. It's also about any sort of big transition we go through. And her point was that we can't anticipate the ways that changes change us.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can say I want to become a parent. I can say I want to move cities. I want to change careers. And I won't really fully know what that's like until I do it. And then once I do it, my preferences may change in ways that I can't anticipate. And that's scary. You know, it's like, it's a little bit problematic to not know the ways in which we'll change. But then if you sort of lean into that and have some compassion for yourself, you say, well, at the end of the day, that's the best I can do. The best I can do is to sort of like hope and know and ask people for advice about how their lives are after they've made these changes, and then maybe jump in myself.
I mean, I think the parenting thing, and Paul Bloom talks about this, Dan Pink talks about this, is like, it's hard, and it's not good necessarily most of the time. It is, you know, you don't get sleep. There's things that happen. You know, it's very, very hard. That being said, I don't regret it at all. Right. I don't think you probably don't either, but I mean, and this is again, why I don't want to meet that future self. because for me, it's sort of like the discovery aspect is the joy for me, you know, or the zag. You know, I thought it was going to be a zig. This ended up being a zag. Oh, well, that's fun. And I know for other people, they want it to be predictive. But I think the reality that you're saying is, you actually say in the book, quote, we can never really know our future selves.
That's right. That's right. And I stand by that. And well, you know, you've got me now really rethinking like whether I'd want to go through that gate. You're like, should the opportunity present itself, maybe think twice.
Yeah, I think you're better off being here. I thought this idea that you play with in chapter three is around relationships with our future selves, and I was really quite moved by the story of Arnie Johnson, who was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease and started writing letters.
Yeah.
So what kind of letters did he start writing?
So this was years and years ago. And this was a man who was diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And he starts writing letters while he's, you know, sort of slowly deteriorating, so much so that he even starts dictating them to his nurse. Now, I heard this story from his son, Ryan, who's, you know, in his mid to late 40s now. And he was around 10, I think, at the time. And, you know, when his father was going through this, and he said, I didn't know what he was doing, but I knew he was always writing letters. The day Arnie dies, Ryan's the one who actually finds him. And he says, you know, amidst all of the shock and confusion and sadness and all the things, some of which are expected, some of which aren't, his mother hands a letter to him. And the letter is from Arnie, from his father. And it's basically a letter saying, you know, more or less, here's what I want you to think about this day. Like while, you know, the day that I've gone, he's written the letter to be delivered the day that he dies.
Yeah.
But he wrote dozens of these to his other kids, to his wife, to friends. And he wrote these letters for milestones in his kid's life. So, you know, I said, I just talked to Ryan, but it was, you know, when he's going to graduate college and high school, and when he himself has his own first kid. And interestingly, he even wrote letters for milestones that would occur to his son that he hadn't yet experienced.
Wow.
Which is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
I really was drawn to that story because I think it was suggestive of the idea that there's this version of the self that can kind of continue on. Mm-hmm. I think we know this. There's nobody that's, you know, sort of surprised by that idea, right? That, you know, sure, we carry memories with us. But to me, this was a really concrete example of essentially having the values and ideals of somebody sort of get intentionally infused, or at least, you know, made salient for one's offspring, you know, in a way that lasted far beyond their mm-hmm. lifetime, far beyond the likelihood that we even tell stories about them, you know?
Right. Right. So that is, so it feels like there's a couple gifts with this. The obvious gift, of course, is to the people that Arnie left behind. But I think the other gift is clearly to himself in terms of, you know, giving back in to what is most important. And I would imagine there's so much literature about writing things down, right?
Right.
That seems so simple. But I mean, I recall in therapy, everything from, write this thing down and then throw it away to whatever other kinds of journaling you might be doing. But then that act of doing that forces you to be very concrete in terms of what is important, not just what is important, how it might be important. And then that really relational thing. I don't know. It was very, very moving.
I agree with you. You know, it's interesting because from a, you know, I'm a researcher first and foremost, and I would love to do the research study where you actually get people to do, you know, the well-controlled study where you get people to write these letters to their offspring and loved ones, you know, far beyond their own lifetime. I'm so curious what it would actually do. And I think your insights are spot on. Like, I think it would have to be sort of legacy boosting. I think it might provide some clarity for values, and but it also might make you feel as if, you know, a little bit more relaxed about, you know, eventually leaving the world.
So you used to be into Guster.
That's a great transition.
I needed to get to this, and I know it's later in the book, but I'm not going to have this guy because I put Guster on my 4th of July playlist, and it definitely, and my wife, and I've not talked to my wife about this book very much. I have a little bit, but I didn't tell her this part, and she was like, "This is a retro playlist from Kelly Leonard," and I'm like, "Yeah, I have a little Amsterdam on there." I think they were recently, and I just got my tickets to Squeeze and the Psychedelic Furs, who are coming to
Wow, that's an even further back.
It's even further back. I'm pretty excited.
That's cool.
But you're a big, as I am, you're like the National now. I like him too. Why do you talk about this in the book?
Yeah. Because I want everyone to know what my musical preferences in the 1990s were, of course.
And end of story.
Yeah, why else would I talk about it? Well, so, I talk about it because one of the sort of ideas I spotlight in the book is one called the end of history illusion, which is a great name for something that some researchers, Jordy Quadbach, Dan Gilbert, Tim Wilson, came up with, which is basically the idea that I know that I have changed from the past to the present. But ironically, I somehow think that my rate of change will slow down as I move from the present to the future. Basically, we somehow think that like now is the period of time that we're fully baked.
Yes.
Which is a very funny notion, because if I can at once recognize that I've changed from the past to the present, why wouldn't I be able to see that the same things would occur moving from the present to the future? Now, the reason this is really interesting is because one consequence of this mistake is that we may lock our future selves into decisions that we might not really make if we were appreciative of the fact that their preferences, their ideals, their values may change just as ours have in the past. Now, in the research paper, they asked people how much would they pay to see their favorite band from 10 years ago.
Right.
And it's considerably less than how much would they pay to see their favorite band now in 10 years. And this sort of wrinkle there is that I can say in my own life, Guster was coming to play at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. This is like, it's actually like a really cool venue.
Yeah.
And this is right before COVID. I want to say the tickets were like $20. They weren't that much per person compared to how much tickets.
And you didn't get the Guster tickets?
And I was like, this is a little LA details for you, but like that's a killer drive on a weeknight, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Like I came up with all sorts of reasons to be like, that'd be fun, but I don't think I'm going to do it. Now, meanwhile, the National plays and I'm like finding like, how can I like, take out a small loan to pay for these tickets. And if you asked me, would I still want to see them in the future? Like I'd say, yeah, how could my preferences change? And it's just a really funny example. That's a funny example, I think, of how we don't fully appreciate our preferences changing. And yet like it can really work out to be detrimental if we in other contexts.
It's funny. My music story on this is, so when I'm older than you, and I grew up a Deadhead. So and we're talking original Dead, Jerry Garcia. Totally. And then he dies, and I am not into any of the sort of what I used to call the fake Dead bands. Yep, and I have a bunch of friends who would, and they'd go to Fish and everything. And I'm just like, nope, this is like that wasn't the scene. And then I think there's a couple years ago, I happened across some bootleg as one does, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to watch this. And it was John Mayer with it, and they were great. And I was like, oh, this is really. And so they're on their final tour. I said to my wife, I'm like, am I okay spending $1,000 to get one ticket to go see the Dead at Wrigley Field? And she's like, if you want to, like you can. And I didn't. I did not. But I was real close, but it did bring up the sort of negotiation of like, okay, what is it that I remember? What am I looking for? And what I knew by not, I really didn't think I would regret it in the long run, because my values are a little bit different now, in the sense that I probably value more sitting in my garden with a book and a glass of scotch.
Yep.
And old Kelly would be like, you're the most boring human being alive.
Totally. Yeah, I say totally because I agree. You sound like the no. I'm just kidding, but but no, I mean, this is, by the way, I think this is at least to me quite relatable. You know, sometimes I think about that time travel trip. Yeah. Like, if I were to have like zoomed ahead and been like, I am totally content. You know, we just finished watching Jury Duty.
Yeah,
and. It, like the amount of contentment that I got from sitting around having a glass of wine, watching that with my wife was actually, I think I may be misremembering, far outweighed the contentment I got from like going to a party in college. No, I mean, obviously there's different goals and there's different, mm-hmm. all mm-hmm. sorts of things change, but how funny to not be able to recognize that. And then you start asking yourself, what sort of things in the future will I be doing that this version of me right now would look at and look at quizzically and say, how is that something you're doing? And I don't know.
I'm curious because this comes up all the time on this podcast and it's, I forget if it was Gretchen Rubin or something. It's like my third or fourth podcast, someone used the term me search. Which at that point, 5 years ago, I had not heard.
Yes. But
every one of you is doing me search. There's just no, I've yet to find someone who's not doing me search.
100%. 100%.
Okay. So are you trying to hack yourself for future happiness or what's going on here?
No, you know, it's funny because I mean, when I first started doing it, I didn't see the me search connection as well. Huh. But there's, you know, look, there's certain, one thing to keep in mind is that all of this stuff, there's sort of domain specificity, which is a fancy term to say I can be future oriented in some spaces and not in other ones, you know? And so in, you know, for me, it's like, look, I've thought about this stuff. I take care of, you know, I take care of our finances and, you know, my health and this sort of stuff. But then like with relationships, uh-huh. this is where I think, you know, not to get like too personal, but sometimes I really overvalue the present. And what I mean by that is like, I'm pretty conflict averse. You know, I try to avoid a conflict and I wait and wait. And it's like, that's a real version of prioritizing my comfort in the present and, mm-hmm. you know, really sort of devaluing like the eventual discomfort I'll feel in the future when like I haven't taken care of something. Or, you know, another version of this is like being fully present in my interactions, which sounds weird. It's like, I think about the future and then I'm not fully present, but you know, my kids are little and I've been really thinking about this a lot lately where I hit that moment of boredom and pull up my phone and they're right nearby. And then my son asked me the same question twice. And I'm like, man, what, like, how bad is that? Like what could I possibly be doing on my phone that would be worth ignoring this, you know? And then, you know, of course it's like, I get it. Everybody does this. Right. But So my version of the me search is to try to figure out, you know, what are the ways that I can like act now so that later on I'll be like more satisfied with my choices. But like to hack my future self, I don't know if I'm quite there.
Yeah. Yeah. I refuse to put TikTok. I got TikTok on my phone, took it off. I can't. Yeah. I didn't. And my son's always watching stuff on there. I'm like, I just can't. I'm already too addicted to what I have.
Yep.
And mostly, I use it for work purposes. But you know.
Yep. Yep.
These are very, very powerful devices. And I think what's interesting too, and this comes up a lot in the pod, you write in the book, quote, "Happiness and sadness were not two poles of one dimension, but rather could peacefully coexist." This is a hard thing for people to understand. And it's there is no suffering without joy. There's no joy without suffering. And this is something that has been taught to us many, many times. Yet we still don't seem to like it. But it's just a fact of what it means to be a human. And we are social creatures. So we are always going to be connected to people, whether we're in a room with them or not. And that at the end of the day, I think is for me, one of the most sort of profound ways that I don't lose it every day based on, oh, I don't know, the fact that I couldn't walk outside in Chicago last week because it was impossible to breathe the air while the Supreme Court is handing down judgments I find deplorable.
Right.
While there's shootings going on, you know, 30 miles from me or sometimes three blocks from me.
Right. Right. No, I mean, I think this is, one of the hardest things to grapple with, that we sort of start with the notion that the emotions we experience should be sort of, you know, opposing each other. Like, if I'm happy, I can't be sad. If I'm sad, I can't be happy. I think that notion, by the way, is really problematic, because like you said, it may mean that there are times when there's plenty of things to be sad about around us, and then we somehow miss the positive things because we're so focused on those, and vice versa. We could, you know, so much lean into the positive that we ignore the little cracks along the way, only to find that they've gotten worse and bigger over time. You know, the sort of personal example of this I remember is like when my daughter started going to preschool, and I would, you know, drive her home and say, how was your day? And it was like silence. And I realized, you know, after talking to her teacher, that that's a really confusing question for a 2-year-old, because how was your day? There's so many things that have happened, you know, and it's like, oh, tell me a good thing. Tell me a bad thing. Tell me times when they're both there. All of a sudden I could get her talking. Mm-hmm. And I think the same is true in our adult lives as well, which is that nothing is one flavor. But if we think it's so, that's when I think we run into problems. So sort of recognizing the coexistence can allow us to sort of push through and see some insight into the negatives to then ultimately deal with them as we move into the future.
Yeah, I think, you know, just as you know, I mean, we're just so wired to, for that fear part of our brain, especially the unknown, any sort of navigating ambiguity. It's give me a pattern that I can make sense of. What's the heuristic? What's my shortcut that I can take to be like, I've seen this thing before. And it's like, and we're, you know, I worked a bunch with Nick Epley. We're mostly wrong.
Yep. Yes.
So that's also like, no. And of course we are. Like, yeah, the analogy I always use when I'm talking about this is like, the best hitters in baseball are missing the ball 70% of the time.
I love that. I love that. You know, it's like Hall of Fame numbers would, you know.
Yeah. How many shots did Jordan miss? Like,
right.
Way more than he made, probably.
Right. It's such a useful perspective to keep in mind. I remember Elliot Aronson, who is a great social psychologist from the 70s and 80s. I mean, not just from then, but back then he had written that, you know, if a small portion of his research studies sort of quote unquote work out or result in some insight or publishable insight, you know, 30% would be a Hall of Fame numbers.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, that brings up a topic, of course, that's all over social media for better or worse these days. But I mean, the fact that they call it a replication crisis. I mean, I would also call it the scientific method. I don't like it's always been the case.
100%. You know, and it's really interesting because I think we can look at this with two lenses. One lens is part of the problem, I think, is that there was so much pressure to get numbers that were far surpassed Hall of Fame numbers.
Yeah.
And you know, this is not to get too far down the weeds, but that's when researchers start doing questionable practices that lead to results that might not be replicable. But then, you know, your insight, I think, is a great one, which is, well, that, you know, this is part of how science moves forward. We find out which specific things replicate literally, which things sort of conceptually replicate, which ideas sound great, but you know, they're not, mm-hmm. they don't really hold water when they're tested, you know? And so this is, you're right. This is actually moving forward in progress.
So we always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Yeah. So all my research has been on this sort of tendency to focus too much on the now and not later. It's called, you know, myopia. Mm-hmm. And there's also this research on what's called hyperopia, which is that you focus so much on the future that you miss the present. Mm-hmm. You know, you bury your head in, and then you kind of look up and you realize that you've just missed things. And one idea that I've been exploring a lot lately with Jennifer Acker and Cassie Holmes, two of my collaborators, is the idea that when we're making these decisions about things that have consequences now and later, so often we think about them in terms of the weather, and not the weather outside, but the weather, WHETHER, right? So whether I should do this or not. So it's an or approach. You know, I can either do this thing now or do something later. And lately I've been really thinking a lot about the decisions that we make in terms of the, call it the both and, or, mm-hmm. you know, just the when approach, right? So when can I mean, to take a really surface level example, when can I have like a, you know, a big night out eating and drinking, and when does it make sense not to, not just only in the narrow term of like tonight I can or tonight I can't. Well, let's look at the bigger picture. Let's look at, you know, what we're calling sort of that broad view of time. Let's look down at our calendars, both on, you know, a literal level, but also on the big picture, and say, well, when do I want to slot these things in? When am I going to focus on this aspect of my life? And when am I going to focus on another one? Now, we're sort of just in the phase of like really testing this empirically, but it raises this question of, you know, the both and, both the present yeah. and the future.
I mean, that's the superpower of reframing, right? If you've got the ability to reframe something and maybe ask a better question or a different question or that sort of thing, you've opened up all kinds of possibilities. And I think, unfortunately, it's the easier move, like we were talking about before, just to be like, this is going to be good or bad. It's going to be yes or no.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think sort of putting those together, you can sort of recognize, well, there could be the good and the bad. Yeah. And it's like, of course, you know, of course there is.
Yeah, that's what it's going to be. The book is called Your Future Self, How to Make Tomorrow Better Today. Hal Hirschfield, thanks for coming on the pod.
Thanks, Kelly. I really appreciate it.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.